From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during last month's Democratic presidential primary debate. Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke defended his proposal for a mandatory buyback program involving AR-15s and guns with similar characteristics. When challenged about whether he meant that the government was going to confiscate AR-15s, O'Rourke said, quote, "Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore," end quote. That prompted a wave of mocking taunts from gun owners. Maybe you've seen the hats or the shirts, often with a picture of an AR-15 and the words, "Come try and take it." Gun owners have both implied and stated directly that if the American federal government ever tried to enact a mandatory buyback, essentially a compensated confiscation of these types of guns, that there would be violence. There would be an armed insurrection. People would shoot the police who came to confiscate the guns. Writing for the New York Times, author and policy analyst Will Wilkinson makes the case that threatening violence is intended to shut down actual Democratic debate. Wilkinson does not take the side of confiscation per se. He simply argues that there must be space for public debate about gun policy without the idea that if new gun restrictions are passed, people are going to get shot. Tucker Carlson of Fox News warned that a gun buyback would lead to a new civil war. Conservative writer Eric Erickson said it's not a stretch to say there would be armed violence if the government tries confiscation. Wilkinson writes, quote, "Who, you may sensibly ask, granted Tucker Carlson's target demographic veto power over the legislative will of the American people? Nobody. They anointed themselves the real American sovereigns of the realm." And Wilkinson concludes, quote, "I'm not too proud to admit that in my misspent libertarian youth, I embraced the idea that a well-armed populace is a bulwark against tyranny. I imagined us a vast Switzerland, hived with rifles to defend our inviolable rights against Michael Dukakis. What I slowly came to see is that freedom is inseparable from political disagreement, and that holding a trove of weapons as your last line of defense in a losing debate readies you to suppress freedom." End quote. This hour, a conversation about gun policy, threats of violence, and who should be involved in crafting gun policy in the future. First, let me welcome New York Times contributing writer Will Wilkinson back to Connections.
Thanks for having me.
I asked our listeners via social media if they agreed with the premise that if there were an AR-15 ban and confiscation of some sort, would there be violent backlash? And this is one of the rare cases where people across the political spectrum seem to agree, and that mostly the answer is yes, there will be some non-zero level of violent backlash. It's hard to quantify, obviously, but there would be. And, you know, that is a pretty horrifying thing to think about, the idea of people shooting police, shooting workers of the government who are enforcing laws. So give me the premise that you wanted to make the case for in your recent piece.
The funny thing is, like, I don't think I was trying to say something that's really that controversial. What I'm trying to say is that if there is a big threat to public safety, if hundreds of people are getting gunned down in mass shootings, that is a, you know, clear and present danger to public safety, and that democratic publics ought to have the power and authority to, you know, decide what the policy is going to be. Like, people need to be able to protect themselves with the force of law. So if majorities of the country think that it's legitimate and needed to ban the ownership of certain kinds of assault weapons, they ought to be able to do that. That's all I was saying. And that it's a, you know, disturbingly anti-democratic tactic to say, no, you can't even consider that because some of us are so confident that we know exactly what inherent rights human beings have, that if you cross this line that a minority of us have just, you know, put down in the sand, then we will fight back with, you know, retaliatory violence. That's just an incredibly anti-democratic set of assumptions.
I know you've seen some of the criticism, and I'll read it for some of our listeners. Robbie Suave from Reason Magazine engaged with you on Twitter, and he wrote the following. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights explicitly hold that some rights matter more than the will of the Democratic majority, and you are attacking this as some weird far-right gun nut position. You have called people seditious for saying they will not allow you to deprive them of an explicit right that is granted to them under our governing documents. I'm saying that's wrong. Truly, it's absurd. What do you say to Robbie, and what would you say to people who hold that sort of same position?
Well, there's a lot that's in there. First of all, in my column, I went out of my way to mention that there is no enumerated right in the U.S. Constitution to own an assault weapon. Until Washington, D.C. versus Heller, there was no recognized constitutional right for an individual to own guns at all. So that was the first significant ruling that granted an individual right to the ownership of guns. And I think most well-informed folks understand how contested and controversial the original text of the Second Amendment is. It talks about militias. Does it really say that you have to be a member of a militia to own a gun, blah, blah, blah. But my point is that text, what's actually in the Constitution, is incredibly ambiguous. People tend to project their political preferences onto their interpretation of the Second Amendment. And so it just can't be taken as an assumption that everyone recognizes that there is such a right, because there hasn't been historically a right to own these weapons. Currently the law says that it's okay to regulate which weapons people can own. So there was an assault weapons ban until, just a decade or so ago, and it was never struck down as unconstitutional. So Robbie's comment reflects one of the pathologies that I'm trying to get to, which is that you have a minority of the population who is simply positing their policy preferences as a fundamental, inviolable right, and then saying that if duly elected Democratic majorities step over that line, people would be right to violently defend their idea of their rights, not what the rights obviously are, not what the rights are like really in the Constitution, but their favorite interpretation of the Constitution that even the Supreme Court right now does not agree with.
When you talk about Heller, some of the defenders of what they would call gun rights look at the phrase common use, that Heller talked about ownership of guns that are in common use for lawful purposes. They argue that Heller says, look, that's fine. And what is more common use? What is more commonly found than AR-15s and its ilk? What about that, Will?
Well, the point of my piece wasn't even to say that this policy is a good idea. I think it's just a democratically legitimate idea. So the idea of a mandatory assault weapons buyback, I don't know if it would be judged constitutional by the courts or not. I have no idea. But that doesn't mean that it ought to be taken off the table of discussion in democratic deliberation. It's completely ambiguous what the court's going to do. What the court actually says is or isn't constitutional depends on who has control of the presidency and who has control of the Senate, and therefore control of judicial appointments. There's not a fact of the matter about what the Constitution says independent of what the court says. And so you shouldn't try to short circuit the entire process of democratic deliberation, democratic legislation, and judicial review of duly passed legislation simply by asserting that you already know what the outcome of that is going to be, and use that to try to chill discourse by convincing people that it's you shouldn't even think about this, because if this were ever passed into law, and if it were ever found constitutional, despite my ideas about what the Constitution ought to say, then people are going to respond violently. Right? Like, I just think that that's a way of chilling the discourse. It's a way of trying to shut down debate, and that's not what we do in a democracy.
So lastly, Will, I'm sure you have seen this kind of response as well, which I saw in large numbers on social media when I posted about this, which is that you have a segment of the population that own these kinds of weapons who love to say that you guys who don't own these guns, you don't get it. You don't get that AR-15s shoot as fast or as slow as any other semi-automatic weapon, long guns and handguns, that you can go out and buy other weapons and dress them up to make it look like military-style weapons, that it's actually just part of a category of weapons, and that people like you who don't get these guns, you shouldn't be drawing up laws because you don't get it. What do you say to that, Will?
One response you can give is that it's ironic that a minority of people, and this is a very, 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 very small minority of the population owns an AR-15. You know, by some estimates, there's about 5 million of these weapons in the country. This country of 300 million people. There are, you know, fewer owners than there are guns because many people who own them own, you know, multiple weapons. So, you know, this is a few million people at best. And a few million people doesn't get to tell the rest of us that we don't have any right as a democratic public to set policy that affects, you know, their specific hobby because we don't get fine distinctions between kinds of guns. Think about the fact that, you know, whenever there's a new restriction on abortion, you know, women who do in fact constitute more than half the population will say, like what gives men the right? You know, legislatures that are almost entirely male in some of these Republican states, what gives them the right to set draconian legislation that has huge implications for women's bodies and women's lives when they clearly don't understand what it's like to be pregnant, what it's like to give birth, how much this can threaten your health, how much, you know, how much it can change the entire course of your life? Like, if that line of argument were legitimate when it came to AR-15s, it's triply legitimate when it comes to abortion. But it's interesting that the same people who are, you know, very dogmatic about their entitlement to a certain kind of gun don't seem to think that way when it comes to something that actually affects way more people's lives way more deeply.
My thought on that was, and I don't say this to be trolling, I mean, there are people like Adam Weinstein and many others who own and have operated this kind, these kinds of firearms and are on the side of a ban. You could definitely find people who own and use these weapons to help design a logical ban democratically if you wanted to. And I take the point that you should get as much expertise into the process as you can. That's fine. But Will, it strikes me that if someone wants to kind of push back against this and what they're saying is, oh, well, you want to ban the AR-15 because it fires X amount of rounds per second or per minute. Well, there's actually lots of guns that do that. That seems to me to be like actually a call for a much broader ban, not more narrow. If what the population is saying, what we need is to eliminate from general society weapons that can do X, Y, Z. If they're saying there's lots of weapons that can do that, I don't think that defends the AR-15 very well. Do you?
I certainly do not. That is a better argument for broadening a ban than it is for, you know, targeting it at this specific weapon. There's a good point that just targeting a weapon that just looks a certain gnarly way doesn't make a lot of sense if what you're interested in public safety. I take it that what the public is worried about in this specific case, you know, it's totally true, as many people will tell you, that mass shootings constitute a very small minority of the gun violence that takes place in the United States in any given year. But mass shootings do have a terrorizing effect that has a real impact on people's sense of security and safety. You know, I'm personally worried that my elementary school for my, you know, kindergartner is going to have some of these mass shooter drills because they're overly freaked out about the possibility that this will happen. I don't want them traumatizing my kid because of it, but people are traumatized because of these kinds of shootings. And there's a real reason why people might want to do something about these incredibly deadly mass shooting assaults. And I think there's every reason why to think that it's completely justified to want to do something about that. And if the reason that these assaults are so deadly is that these guns can shoot so many bullets in a minute or a second. The shooting in Dayton, I think it was 9 people were killed in 32 seconds, and you know, many more people were shot. I mean, that is atrocious. Nobody needs a gun that can shoot that many people that quickly for personal self-defense. So if there are other guns that can shoot just as many people just as quickly, there's very sensible grounds for regulating the sale and ownership of those weapons as well. But my point isn't that we ought to do this. My point is that people ought to be able to deliberate about public safety, about the regulation of deadly weapons in a context of free and open democratic debate without having the discussion short-circuited by some people vaguely threatening that there'll be retaliatory violence.
I read that piece to say, look, if you're one of the people who wears a hat with a picture of an AR-15 and it says, come and try to take it, as I saw this past weekend, if you are one of those people, then you are not really acting in the way that our society thinks is acceptable and healthy when it comes to debate and the way the citizenry decides the laws of this particular republic. Not that Will wants this actual ban, but that when you say try it and we'll kill you, we've entered dangerous territory.
Absolutely fair. And I don't think people would accept it if we did it around every single issue. If you take like protections for pre-existing conditions out of people's insurance policies, some people will actually die. And we don't think that it's okay to actually like threaten terrorizing violence in retaliation for duly passed legislation in those other cases. And there's nothing special about guns.
That's Will Wilkinson, a contributing writer for the New York Times and director of policy for the Niskanen Center in Washington, joining us. And now some guests in studio continuing the conversation with you this hour. Let's start with Jeremy Cooney, who's a former chief of staff for the city of Rochester and a candidate once again for the New York State Senate. That election is still more than a year away. It's in the 56th district. And just want to let you know, we have already recently talked to another possible candidate in that race, Hilda Rosario Escher. And it's nice to have Jeremy back with us. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Glad to be back, Evan.
Also with us is Luke Skiba, who has many years of experience owning and operating firearms. And Luke, thank you for taking the time and being with us as well.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
I already have some phone calls on the line. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation as we talk about gun policy going forward, threats of violence, and who should be leading and participating in policy discourse, you can join the conversation on many platforms, and we'll get more of your feedback as we go throughout the hour. But let me start by asking both of our guests in studio. If you do expect, let's just be in a world now where there is some kind of a ban, and that ban includes not, we're not going to grandfather anybody in. That means if you own whatever the ban is, there's going to be a forced buyback, which probably should be described as confiscation with compensation. Do you expect there would be violence, a violent backlash of some kind? Jeremy Cooney.
I actually disagree with Will and his statement and what he said earlier. I don't think that there would be violence in terms of you take my gun, I'm going to react to that with my gun.
Even despite all the threats there are?
Even despite, I think there's a lot of bluster happening on both sides. And, quite frankly, I think a lot of it is driven by some of the talking heads, not here at WXXI, but talking heads on national news streams that I think incites a lot of emotional response. But people still have their opinions, and that's valid. There are people on both sides. And, the district that I'm running in, Evan, has a pretty I would say diverse opinion when it comes to gun safety measures. And so you have people who will wear those hats that you described on air earlier who say, do not take my guns. And you've got a lot of people who are saying no guns at all, right? And so it's a real challenge as a political candidate, as a leader in this community, to find a middle ground there. But I do think that cooler heads will prevail, and I do not believe you'd see that kind of violence here.
Luke, do you think there'd be violence?
So we have almost 400 million civilian guns in the U.S., and if there were a widespread confiscation, which is what that is, you're definitely going to have a few seeds that are going to fight back and not give up their guns. To think otherwise is short-sighted, especially if this happens, broadly. However, to the extent to which that will happen, I think would be very minimal. However, if a buyback or a confiscation is established without data backing it or purpose, if it's not based on the ability of what that gun can do or what that component can do, I think it would be a much greater backlash. Whereas, when we have magazine limits or bump stock limits and things like that, and on local levels where they've done forced buybacks, you don't really see a lot of issues with that.
Even if people don't like that law.
Yes, correct, because it's functionally based. It's not just AR is scary, and it doesn't even mean assault rifle.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a myth that most people think AR means assault rifle.
But... Armalite, but it's a brand.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Kleenex.
But the bottom line is what you're saying is if the policy is crafted in a way that is specific to the function of the weapons, even if the people who own those weapons don't like it, they will respect that there was a knowledge based in the policy?
Yes, assuming there is a thoughtful and objective conversation around it in developing this. Yeah, gun owners aren't short-sighted.
I agree with Luke. I don't think we're giving people enough credit here. I think that most gun owners are responsible individuals who enjoy whether they're using it for sport purposes or whether they are working on a protective measure for their families. Most gun owners are absolutely responsible, follow the rules, and want to do what's right. I think there are extremes, as Luke said, on both sides.
Okay, but Luke, as someone who has plenty of experience with firearms, does it frustrate you to see some of the discourse driven by people who don't have a lot of knowledge on operating firearms?
Absolutely, and the same goes for any topic where, you know, if we have people arguing healthcare in Congress that have no experience in healthcare, you know, the same applies to gun ownership. I think it's, you know, we need to have a table that everybody comes to and talks about because guns, whether or not you own them, impact you, you know, and the actions taken by those with guns impact people that own guns and don't own guns equally. So we need to, everybody needs to come together. The people that own guns need to be thoughtful about, you know, this is how they work. Here's the data behind them. And the people that don't own guns need to accept that, look at it, and come to a thoughtful agreement.
Okay. You agree with that, Jeremy?
Yes, to some degree. I don't think, and I don't think it's what you're saying, Luke, per se, but I don't think that gun ownership is an automatic disqualification for coming to the table and having that conversation. And I think there are some people who believe that, right? So I do not own a gun. I do not have a permit to own a gun. But I have shotguns, right? I've come on this program before and talked about growing up in the Boy Scouting program and earning rifle merit badge. I've shot guns for sport, right? In a protective way where I was learning from experienced individuals who own guns and know how to handle guns safely. That does not mean that I'm a gun expert, but I would like to be coming to the table and be part of the solution-finding process, which I think Luke agreed.
But there's a distinction here. There's a difference. And in a moment, Charles in particular, I know you pulled over Charlie in Seneca Falls to call, so I'm going to grab your call in just one second here. I appreciate a lot of feedback already on this. But there's a distinction between participating in a discourse about what we want for policy and actually writing the policy. Because the people who write the policy, I do happen to agree with a lot of firearms owners who are frustrated. The people who actually write the policy better understand it. And in this state, there's some frustration with the SAFE Act, which I think a lot of gun owners feel like was a little quick and ham-fisted and wasn't really written by people who understand guns that well, or at least was kind of intended to not just function in the way the law was written, but to kind of be a little bit of an overreach in to their perspective. And I understand that. I do understand that. That does not say, though, that the public discourse should only include gun owners or people with experience, because that's the part where I think firearms owners sometimes get a little condescending. You know, they'll say, oh, well, Jeremy, you don't own a gun, so what do you know about it? You don't get to participate in this conversation. Well, yes. If we have goals of outcomes in society with reproductive rights or taxes or universal basic income, healthcare, gun ownership, everybody gets to participate to some degree. I think we should respect expertise, and then the policy should be written by people with experience. That's where my perspective is. I think that's fair. Is that fair?
I completely agree. I mean, if you don't have experience with something, you can still have an opinion, but you have to bring somebody to the table that has experience, and they have to also accept that that's what you're there for. Like, we're bringing you into this discussion to offer this data and this advice and this thoughtful discourse, and we're going to draw some conclusions together and compromise and come to a conclusion. I mean, that's how legislation happens. I mean, it shouldn't happen just behind closed doors by the government. We need to bring in, you know, people and have a panel, so to speak, on this at a broad scale.
Was the SAFE Act a good or a bad example?
I don't know enough about the SAFE Act because I'm fairly new.
Oh, Luke, you don't understand how this works. You must have an opinion on everything, even if you don't have done it. No, I respect that.
Yeah.
That's very admirable. So let me ask the guy who's running for a state Senate seat. Were you happy with how the SAFE Act was passed?
So just kind of a little history lesson here. The SAFE Act passed in 2013, and it was a very different government that we had in New York State. Right at that time, the Republicans controlled both chambers of the legislature, and the Senate, which is usually the chamber where a lot of the in-depth policy debate conversation happens in New York State, was controlled by upstate New York Republicans, right? Including the representatives from the Greater Rochester area. So I would say a little bit of tongue in cheek here that the process that came through, yes, it may have been politically expedient for the Democratic governor to push this legislation, but there was a very thoughtful discussion about the legislation in the legislative chambers through the legislative process that was controlled by upstate Republicans.
Okay. Let me go ahead and get a little feedback from listeners, and then we've got a lot to work in the next half hour here. Charlie in Seneca Falls, first up. Thanks, Charlie. Go ahead.
Okay. First, I am a gun owner. I've been a gun owner 60 years, almost, I guess, at this point. Waterfowl hunters, since long before I was born, more than 100 years ago, had to limit the number of shotgun shells that they had available to shoot in the gun. It's three, whether it's a single shot shotgun, a double barrel shotgun, or some kind of a pump or automatic loading shotgun. If you have more than three or the capacity to put more than three in the gun and you get checked, you're breaking the law and you'll pay a fine or lose your right to hunt. And I wasn't around when that law was passed, but it's been that way forever. So there's a good precedent for limiting magazine size. Secondarily, the whole point of, oh, you're going to pry my gun from my cold, dead hands, to paraphrase Charlton Heston. If and when, and I think we will pass a law limiting urban assault weapons, I'm going to call them high capacity, high fire, high velocity weapons, and someone tries to shoot the police or the law enforcement officer who comes to confiscate that weapon, I feel sorry for the law enforcement officer who might get shot. That'll only happen once or twice because the shooter won't survive very long. The law enforcement doesn't take well to being shot at. They've, in effect, self-identified. So that's a bogus argument. Hmm. People follow the law in this country in general. And that's all I've got.
All right, Charlie, thank you for the phone call. So let me turn to Luke Skiba again, so someone who's got decades of experience with firearms. He's talking about magazine size. So let's talk about how if we set a goal, and again, this is totally hypothetical, but let's say there is strong public sentiment that the public doesn't want people to own weapons that can shoot X amount of bullets per minute. And that may not be the best metric. What Charlie is saying is you start with magazine size. If the goal is reducing the speed, the velocity with which someone can spray bullets into in a time and place, do you start with magazines? What's the mechanism you look at?
So magazines is one mechanism, you know, the amount of bullets that can be shot from a semi-automatic weapon, because, I mean, semi-automatic is basically as fast as you can pull the trigger. And then there's things like bump stocks, which a lot of locales have already outlawed, because if anyone's shot a bump stock, you know how intimidating it can be, because you're essentially shooting an automatic weapon.
It feels like full auto.
It feels like full auto. So as long as a bump stock with a small clip really doesn't matter that much if your magazine's only shooting four or five bullets. So, I mean, we have to regulate, you know, based on the functional ability of the gun. So limiting, you know, maybe magazines to seven bullets. I mean, when are you going to need to pull the trigger seven times in a row? That's not in a fun environment, maybe in a gun shop or something like that, which is fine. In these closed environments, fine. Let people have a little more leeway with how they want to shoot their guns. But out in public, you know, the general public having access to these guns in high capacity, 12 plus round magazines with bump stocks, that can spray a room down really quickly. And I think he's right. You know, people will listen if these are functional laws put into place. But if you're going to generally put a law in place to take a gun away, it might not work out that well.
On the flip side of that, when you hear people say, we'll just ban AR-15s, and they don't really know what that means, well, you're laughing. So explain why you're laughing.
Because an AR-15 is just a scary-looking version of a semi-automatic rifle. I mean, the AR-15 was built in order to allow people to modify it more easily and make it more affordable of a firearm. So, I mean, you're not banning anything that's going to change except for the way that the gun looks out in the public. And somebody that's out there and wants to shoot multiple rounds with big magazines can still do it with a gun that has a wood muzzle, you know.
Okay. And by the way, with bump stocks, even the Trump administration stepped in post-Las Vegas. The mass shooting in Las Vegas using a bump stock is what I think spurred the federal action. And as NPR reported, I think that took effect in March. But to Luke's point, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And the thing is, so yes, we're going to outlaw the bump stock. A lot of people will say, you know, it's easy to make something like this by yourself. And an important distinction is when you get rid of these things mass-produced and easily available, you make it more difficult for people to make these crime of passion decisions. And by elongating that period, we limit the number of mass shootings we're going to have.
Okay. Jeremy, what do you make of sort of the productive way to create policy? Again, kind of sitting down and looking at certain metrics. What's a productive way to do this?
So even this conversation, Evan, is a productive measurement, right? So you're talking about very specific components to guns. And so when preparing for today's show, even I was researching and learning about what's included in the SAFE Act, what's not. Mm-hmm. What was included in the 1994 assault weapons ban on the federal level, what's not, right? And it's all these modifications and grips and scopes and things that could escalate raise the gun up to a level where it was unacceptable, right? So I'm learning in that process too. But I think so far what we're seeing in the media, and I think this is what Will was talking about in his article, is that that's not the conversation that takes place. The conversation that takes place is we don't want you to have any guns, including regular old handguns. We don't want you to have any guns, and you're going to take away everything I have, right? And that's misinformation. It's not productive. And so I do think there needs to be more citizen and lawmaker education. And I do believe that Luke's earlier point around including panels and having these conversations maybe didn't happen and needs to happen moving forward. But at the same time, I think we need to really just de-escalate this emotional conversation and really look at it through, I would say, the most important lens, which is when you make this law in New York, how will this impact raising a family? How will this make it better to be a New Yorker, right? Shooting sports are part of being a New Yorker, and that's an important value to you, then you have an opinion on that. Right. If you're raising a family here in Rochester or raising a family in New York, some of the traumatization that Will talked about is very real. And I heard that when I was knocking on campaign doors. Right. People were saying, I'm afraid when my daughter gets on the school bus that she's not going to get off when she gets back. Or I don't like that my kindergartner is going through a shooting drill.
Yeah.
And that back to, again, Will's point, that does have a chilling effect on these conversations. But it doesn't mean that we have to get all excited and start yelling at each other and not find that kind of common ground solution.
One more question for our guests, and then we're going to turn it over to listeners for the rest of the hour, which is this. Will Wilkinson's piece pushes us to at least consider humility. And here's what I mean by that. When we debate guns, we often talk about the Second Amendment. And it's either the Second Amendment is absolute or it's the worst piece of writing in American lawmaking history and they didn't even know how to use commas and it's way too ambiguous and it's outdated. And what Wilkinson puts forward is that we don't have an absolute definition. In other words, it is okay for us to continue to redefine what policy we expect for ourselves as a populace going forward. And nobody has a monopoly on the rights to a declaration of the Second Amendment is X or it is Y, and it is immovably X or it is immovably Y. And the second we start threatening violence implies that only my view can be correct, and if you try to change that, then I may kill you. His point is we have to all be humble, even those who want a ban, even those who want confiscation, even those who want more restrictive laws. but also those who own guns and don't want more restrictive laws, that we need to be humble and allow for that policy to breathe a little and not claim that it has to be violence. It's either one way or it's violence. Do you agree with that, Luke?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely not a black and white subject. So, I mean, we have to, and most, I don't think any are. I mean, there's gray area and everything, and we need to negotiate to the gray area where we're all, not all of us are comfortable. Some people aren't going to be, and, you know, that's okay. But we're trying to move forward as a society.
Okay. Jeremy.
Think about the diversity of opinion that went into the Supreme Court chambers in 2008.
With Heller.
With Heller, right? I mean, you had manufacturing interests in that room. We had the NRA in that room. You had victims in that room. You had very, very smart lawyers on both sides making impassioned, reasoned arguments to the Supreme Court of the United States, who, by the way, you know, it was a split decision, right? It was 5-4. And in that decision, they were really arguing over the merits of what the framers' intent was for the Second Amendment. They were parsing words, right? They didn't maybe get it right. There's a dissent and there's a majority opinion, right? I tend to think that there are merits on both sides of that argument. But the whole point of my conversation about the Supreme Court is that we were able to go through a process that was civil, that was reasoned, that was intellectual, and we walked out of that courtroom where we got the opinion a number of months later, and we were able to survive as a democratic society.
But it wasn't 9-0. Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what we need to do. The problem is right now, and I mean, this is just the way things work now, is all these things get aired out on social media. People have a louder voice if they want it, and we're not taking enough action, you know, at the government level to actually have these discussions and say, okay, we're going to have a discussion about gun violence, and we're going to have these meetings with the Supreme Court and, you know, in a session of Congress where we bring in the NRA, whereas right now we're just demonizing them and telling them to go away for the most part. That's how it feels on social media. But if we bring everybody into the conversation and have those over months and months of time to craft legislation, that's how it works. We need to do that. It doesn't feel like we are.
Humility is good. Humility is good for people who want more restrictions. If they're told by gun owners, you don't get the technical side. I think it's good to be humble and say, okay, educate me. Let's talk about it. And I think it's good for gun owners to be humble when they're frustrated, because I think people want better outcomes for our society. They're not satisfied. Let's get our only break of the hour, and your feedback as we talk about these issues is next. Coming up in our second hour, you will meet a sixth grade student named Oscar who is trying to change his world. His remarkable presentation at Hills Middle School last week went viral in our community. Oscar has driven a power wheelchair since he was 19 months old. Now, his presentation about disability rights and true access is opening doors. We sit down with Oscar next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to mention that we reached out to a number of people about this conversation today. And to the extent that there's two sides, and I think there's more nuance and gray area here, but to the extent that there's two sides, there is a robust community that includes Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, people who've been working for many years to change gun laws. And there are a lot of people on that side, maybe a dozen that we talked to in the last 24 hours, 48 hours, who decided not to come on the show because they feel like if they are seen as even having a conversation about confiscation, that it will spook the gun rights side into thinking that they're all just confiscationists. Couldn't even talk about it. That's how much heat there is about this. So that was sort of a bummer. But there is a real fear of being painted as a certain thing or a certain way. And that's just an interesting little note there. And I'm not going to name any names. There's a lot of people I respect on all sides of this issue who felt like there was too much heat here. John emails the program and says this: no one on your show answered what an assault weapon is. Who are these so-called qualified individuals you want who actually know very little about firearms? You're losing credibility when the people on your show don't truly support different sides. I'm so disappointed you haven't found real gun owners. Okay, Luke, that's John.
Well, so
how many years have you been shooting guns since you were how old?
I shot my first gun around four.
Age four.
Took hunter safety when I was five, And, you know, I've shot just about everything under the sun. I mean, shotguns, all kinds of rifles. My dad was a Vietnam vet, and he collected guns, so we always went out shooting. My family has a bunch of long-range shooters in the family that shoot, you know, mile-plus. So
I wouldn't have invited you, Luke, if I didn't trust your expertise and your experience.
My question is, how would he define assault weapons? Because we have not done a very good job of that in general. You know, what makes an assault weapon is functionality, not a name or a brand.
You know, a look.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, what we call assault weapons are of a certain caliber, or they can rapid fire. You know, an automatic weapon is essentially what we see as an assault weapon in the United States. So, you know, we have things like bump stocks that turn a standard semi-automatic rifle into an automatic weapon.
Do you think any semi-auto is an assault rifle, an assault weapon?
In my personal opinion, no. So, I mean, any weapon can assault. That does not make it an assault weapon, whether or not you can rapid fire it with your finger or not. I think maybe clips. We can have assault weapon quality magazines that have, you know, 10 plus rounds in them.
So in your view, when you hear assault weapon, you're thinking bump stock, effectively fully auto.
Yes.
Okay. Do you get annoyed when you hear assault weapon used as a category, often by people who are not gun owners?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't mean anything.
Okay. Do you think it's not helpful for the discourse when we're actually talking about policy?
Absolutely.
Okay. Jeremy, do you agree?
I would agree. I think there's a lack of understanding. I was thinking when Luke was talking that it's interesting when you hear the 2020 presidential candidates talk and they're talking about gun safety. They're using language now like weapons of war or weapons of mass destruction. We've heard that before. So I think that there is really at the highest levels of political candidates, right? There's a lack of understanding here. And I don't think that's because they don't care. I don't think that's because they don't own guns. I just think that the technology is changing. And I think that the guns themselves are changing. And so I think I agree with Luke's point that it's all about the modifications of these weapons that can make them perhaps qualified as a weapon of war.
Sure. I mean, we're in a capitalistic society where the gun manufacturers want guns to look cool. They want them to look sleek, and they look scary to people who don't own them. But to Luke's main point, you got to be asking about functionality. I get that. I think that makes sense. And John, I appreciate the email, but if you're questioning Luke's gun credentials, you're barking up the wrong tree. Richard, I'm sorry, that's not Richard. I'll get Richard's email in a moment. Let me get Jim and Arondaquit next on the phone. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, I'll ask you to humor me as I ask a question that comes out of that gray area you mentioned earlier. If there was real reason to believe that there was a secret government, a deep state, for lack of a better term, that was behind events such as 9/11 and carried out certain fake terror attacks, fake mass shootings, would you then understand the virulent response and how they would see it not as a confiscation of a specific gun, but the beginning of something, and then the fear would be justified?
So let's do a hypothetical. You're saying if we have evidence that the government was behind something like 9/11, right? That's what
yes.
you're saying? Then
yes.
would it then stand to reason that people who own guns don't want to give them up because the government has already proven to be murderous or conspiratorial? I think yes. I think if you have evidence that the government did 9/11, and if we're going to walk in that world right now, yes. I think that would be more logical for gun owners to not trust the government to confiscate. Luke, do you want to answer that?
So to a point, yes, more logical. However, we have to consider the firepower of the government versus the citizenry. You know, they're not going to come at us with AR-15s. You know, they're going to come at us with fully automatic bombs. I mean, they have...
To the extent that there's a war against the citizenry, it's different than it was when those laws were written.
I mean, Waco had a lot of guns. But, I mean, that's what's going to happen. Like, if the government's going to turn against its people, we're in a lot bigger trouble, and our well-organized militia isn't really going to help.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's an interesting point.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so go ahead, Jim.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think we are in a much bigger morass, if that's the case. And my specific question, you know, I think that's getting off on a tangent about, you know, we're going to get outgunned. This is, my question is more specific about you and your panel understanding the justified fear in the hypothetical, that if that was the case, the fear would be justified and you would have to see this from a different perspective completely.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, but you don't think the government did 9/11, do you?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
it's a whole other conversation.
Well, I mean, that's a conversation that's been had a lot, Jim. And look, hey, I think I do owe you an email or a phone call and a coffee, and I'm happy to get it for you. I'm not sure how much I want to talk about 9/11, but Jim, here's where I hear you. Here's where I hear you. If you're saying that people are not who own weapons don't have fears that aren't fully comprehended, that might be true. I think we can debate whether certain fears are justified, but I think that that's fair.
I should stay for the record. I don't own a firearm.
Okay.
I want to.
Okay.
State that, I don't know, for whatever that's worth in this discussion.
No. I hear you, but let's talk offline, and I'll help you see that the government did not do 9/11. I'm not saying the government's infallible. It ain't. But it also did not do 9/11. Boy, I'm going to get an email over that. It's fascinating.
Yeah, but Evan, I think a point that the key word that I zoomed in on is fear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what is the motivating factor for some of this hyperbole or this language? It's fear. It's fear that, you know, you in government, whomever, whatever party's in control, right?
Yeah.
You in government are going to start by taking away an assault rifle, right? And you don't even know what that means. So you're going to start there, and then all of a sudden, everything's going to go away, and I'm going to have no rights as protected by the United States Constitution.
And the government is as fallible as the citizens. So, I mean, we have to be, you know, honest about that. And so, you know, our elected officials are just like us.
They're citizens.
You know,
we are a citizen-based government.
Like us. You know, whether we craft a law and it's not perfect and we adjust it later on, we're going to keep doing that and improve as best we can. But, you know, we can only find these solutions by coming together.
Let me go ahead and squeeze in some more of your phone calls before the end of the hour. Jack in Greece, got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Jack.
Thanks, Evan. And real quick, hey, Evan, I'm not sure I heard all the comments, but in any event, a couple of thoughts that come to my mind. One is, how much more effective would another New York State law be in terms of regulating guns versus a national effort? The other thoughts have to do with, we hear a lot of folks talk about tyranny. They need to protect themselves, be armed, as if we're still fighting the revolution against the British. Today we have, which we didn't have back then, is we have there's a police force. I have a town police force, county police force, state police force to protect us as citizens. Does everybody need to be armed to the teeth? We talk about guns being, we have the bump stocks that just got regulated. People were buying them over the internet. So to talk about another state law, I'm not sure how effective that is. But it seems like we have a religious fanaticism associated with the Second Amendment now and tyranny. So I'll leave it at that, but generates a lot of thoughts. Thanks for listening.
Jack, thank you. So Jack used the phrase armed to the teeth. One question for Luke, who's had experience operating firearms since he was 4 years old. Do you think it's logical that people would want to put a ban on how many guns a person can own? Some people own tens of dozens of, some people own hundreds. Should there be a limit?
No. I mean, it's a hobby like any other, honestly, for a lot of these people. You know, if you like to shoot a shotgun or a revolver or, you know, a Glock.
I'm with you there, but let me try the counterpoint, and this is just a thought experiment. Most gun owners are extremely responsible. They're well-trained. They respect it. They are very careful. We know that the number of gun owners who are not responsible is not zero. And in society, when the guns can do as much damage as they are, this may penalize all gun owners, so to speak, in terms of the opportunity for ownership. But if society decides if it's not zero, then that's too much, and we're going to have to put limits. Because if you own 100 weapons and one gets stolen or left behind somewhere, we're in trouble here.
Yeah, so I think we need, we need regulation that punishes these types of situations where your gun gets stolen by somebody that does something nefarious, or and also, background checks, at every transfer of a gun, like you have with a car, that people should have to be licensed and approved to have these things, or they should at least pass a background check, whether it's a private sale or public. But we need to develop the systems that enable that simply for people.
Okay, Jeremy?
Reasonableness, right? That's the key word here, is that we can come together around what are some reasonable restrictions. Back to that legal case Heller that we talked about before, and I know I'm a kind of a nerdy lawyer here, so I'm focusing on that case, but that case said that there could be reasonable restrictions put on gun ownership. And it was that right, the Second Amendment right to bear arms was not unlimited. The question is then, what are those reasonable restrictions? And are they, in fact, reasonable? I will say that I had the chance to hear a bunch of residents and neighbors in Brighton this spring talk about the Safe Storage Act. And there are people who own multiple guns, and they want to do what's best. They want to store their firearms safely away from children who could cause harm. So I think that's the community that we live in here in Rochester. And I think that if lawmakers are open to listening to these ideas, lawmakers are open to finding reasonable common ground solutions, we can do a lot of good and get away from the scare tactics on both sides.
Jeremy Cooney is a former chief of staff for the city of Rochester, candidate for the New York State Senate in 2020 in the 56th District, and you'll hear him and the various people running for that seat many times on this program. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Luke Skibbe, with many years of experience owning and operating firearms, and thank you for the perspective and the expertise.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Short break, more connections coming up.